You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 62. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today with me is Jeff C., and we are going to be talking about interactions with law enforcement. Jeff, welcome.
What's up? How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. So, kind of give us just a you know, maybe a smidge of background of how you came to these ideas and these philosophies, like why this matters to you, and then we'll get into it.
Sure. And most people probably don't know who I am. I'm just a nobody. I'm not an expert, and this is not legal advice. I consider myself an activist. I got into Bitcoin for the freedom side, separating money from the state. And I've spent the last 3 years hanging out with, I guess you call them civil rights activists, and then some more freedom-minded activists, a part of the No State Project, which is a radio show that a guy named Mark Stevens hosted. And he basically talked strategy on how to navigate the court system yourself, defending yourself against bureaucrats or politicians, specifically for nonviolent victimless crimes. So that's how I got here, and I've been listening to podcasts recently, hear a lot about privacy and OPSEC on the technical side, and really just see a kind of a hole in the meat space side, and what's the best strategy or what's most effective if you're being attacked by a politician or a bureaucrat.
Okay, great. So let's say, I'm trying to think what's a scenario that I want to put forth. Do you want to talk about the tax stuff first, or you want to talk about like dealing with police first?
Yeah, well, the police one, you really should never talk to a cop. And I think I sent a link to a video of a professor explaining why, and you can leave that in the show notes. But
yeah,
basically,
for sure.
Nothing good can come of it. And even using this strategy of Socratics is kind of risky. Essentially, you, when dealing with a police officer or a cop, you just want to mitigate the violence and get out of there. So I don't advocate doing a verbal battle with a five-year-old with a gun. So we can talk about like the taxes, or just like future laws that they might write and say apply to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's an existing law, right? Or not an existing law. Let's be careful. There is an existing place in the current U.S. tax code that's got a place to, I guess, volunteer information if you've, made any money on the buying and selling of cryptocurrency. What's your take on that?
Yeah. So, I would ask, if anybody's asking about money I've made on crypto, or if I own any or control any, really, I would just ask them what obligation do I have to you to even give you this information? You're a stranger. I don't know you. In the case of a tax form, it really relies on voluntary reporting. That's why everybody fills out the forms or has someone represent them, fill it out, and then submit it. And then they use the information you provide to then attack you. So my suggestion is not to fill out any forms that are quote unquote voluntary. I understand most people currently, unless you're all in on Bitcoin, you're going to have a job. If you have a job, they're going to take taxes out and you're going to basically file this paperwork. But I think as the years go on, we're going to find more and more Bitcoiners that are independently wealthy, don't have a job, and don't have this tax reporting burden. And these people are the ones that would be most effective using this strategy. And I know that that's, we're talking about like such a small sliver of people. But that's besides the point. I mean, we can still all use these best practices for privacy, I guess, in the meat space.
Okay. So let's say you have a job or don't even need, let's say you're just living on your Bitcoin riches, or you've got, you know, a side thing where you're earning in Bitcoin and that's the only job you have. It's not something that anyone's sending you a W-2 for, and, you know, they're not taking out taxes before you get your direct deposit. And then let's say they try and institute some kind of tax on Bitcoin or something along those lines.
Yeah, and that's the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that they can't really enforce any codes or statutes. They'll label them laws, and we can get into that a little bit about how words are used to manipulate people and be deceptive. There's not really a way they can enforce it. So a hardcore Bitcoiner that's an activist would just say, look, you have to use violence on me and lock me up in a cage. But the strategy to go, I guess, would be to anytime somebody contacts you for information, you would use the Socratic method of investigation to get them to tell you what obligation you have to them. Or, you know, if they may claim, we have authority over you. I'm an IRS agent. I have authority to ask you these questions. And at that point, you would ask for the evidence to prove that claim. And
so, yeah. Okay. I was going to say, let's say they come to you and they say, hey, look, we've seen that you've used Coinbase or Kraken or Cash App. We've got, you know, the record that you bought this amount of Bitcoin. Oh, you know, you're buying on the regular this much Bitcoin every 2 weeks. Now what?
They wouldn't be asking me anything at that point. They're just making a claim that they know about it.
But then they're saying, like, but you, okay, so, you know, given this new law that we've created, you owe us X amount.
And I would ask for the evidence that, basically, I would ask for, they're claiming that they have a rule, and because of this rule, that I owe them Bitcoin. So I'm going to ask them for evidence that their rule applies to me. And this is where they get binded up, because there is no evidence. People claim the Constitution, bureaucrats and politicians will claim that they get their power and their authority ultimately from the Constitution. So they point right to that document. And so the question is how is a 200-year-old document written by men that are dead apply to me here today?
So, yeah, I mean, and I haven't read Lysander Spooner, but my understanding is that the basic argument is kind of that, like, none of us were around, like, you can't sign a contract and, you know, force your three generations down, you know, grandchildren to abide by some contract that you sign.
They didn't even sign it.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, yeah, you're right. But, a contract implies that there's an agreement and there's consent. So the main thing that this document's missing is consent. And we know that according to the rules for like court and everything, that jurisdiction, which is basically them saying they have authority to impose on you. We know it's legit because you can look at the UCMJ, which is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and they will produce this document that you signed and say, this right here says that we have authority over you.
Wait, what did you... I'm confused. What did you sign?
Okay, so in the military, so if you join the military, you have to sign a document called the UCMJ, which basically says that they have jurisdiction over you, that you have to follow these rules, and that if you, because these, you're going to be deployed outside of the country, and if you violate any of the rules, they want to be able to produce a document that says we have authority to impose on you. They do it for the military, but they don't do it for other people. And so my point is that if you go, if you're in the military and you try to raise this position of jurisdiction or asking for evidence of jurisdiction, they're going to actually produce evidence and give it to you. But if you go into a civilian court and do this, ask for the same thing, you're going to get a runaround.
Oh, okay. Okay. So what does that look like? Like, kind of walk me through an example of how you might use this.
Right. Okay. So when you go into court, there's a thing called the burden of proof. And these are all their rules, right? And they're essentially summoning you to court to this. It's basically a church. It's got somebody in a black robe instead of a white robe. They've got a wooden hammer instead of a cross, and they both have Bibles. I mean, it's literally like a religion. But part of the rules say that if you make a claim, the burden of proof is on you. So the prosecutor is claiming that you violated or broke one of their rules. So when you go in there and you ask for evidence of this and they can't produce any, they basically try to railroad you through. And the key is at arraignment. In order to get past arraignment, which is where they allegedly inform you of the allegations, they then want you to enter a plea of guilty or not guilty and then handle this representation thing. Do you have a lawyer? You're going to represent yourself. And they can't really proceed unless they have both those boxes checked. And so we know this. And so when we go in there, we have what we call a scorecard, or it's basically a judge's ethics scorecard. But you go in there and you ask questions. It's the Socratic method of investigation. They made the claim. And so, I mean, we can kind of role play through it. If you can read me the charges, and I would say, you know, I intend to plead guilty here today. But first, I'd like to know, do I have a right to a fair and meaningful hearing here today? And no judge is going to say that you don't have a right to a fair and meaningful hearing. Okay. And then we're going to clarify, do I have the right to be informed of the cause and nature of these proceedings? And these are all the rules. They're not going to say, no, you don't have the right to be informed of the cause and nature. And then you're going to get them. So what we're doing is, since we know the rules, we're basically creating a record, and we're getting them to actually put these things down on the record. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're asking questions so that you are creating your kind of own, counter body of evidence in your favor.
Yeah. Right. We're on an investigation
by their own admission.
Yeah. Well, we're on an it's a Socratic method of investigation. They're claiming we broke these rules. And we're asking, do these rules apply? And they may apply, right? We don't know. Our position, we're not taking a position that these rules don't apply. And we make that clear, because if you say your rules don't apply to me, that is making a claim. And now they're shifting the burden of proof onto you, and you're not going to win.
Mm.
And so, like, a fair and meaningful, like, what does fair mean and what does meaningful mean? Well, like, meaningful means that you get to make progress. You know, fair is like their due process. The right to be informed, you actually cannot make a guilty plea unless you say that you've been informed. They ask you, you know, you're going to plead guilty here today. You know, have you been informed? Is anybody coercing you? So, and to be informed means about everything. And when they say, yes, you have the right to be informed, but then 2 minutes later, when you ask for the evidence that the when you ask, has the prosecution submitted any evidence, and they want to shut you down, you know, any evidence regarding jurisdiction, not what is it, just have they done it? They won't answer. And at that point you said, look, you said just a minute ago that I had the right to be informed. And so what's changed? And you get this, you know, you're in
blank stare.
Yeah. Yeah. it's interesting. So, Mark Stevens, he did this, what they call like a traffic ticket study, where people from all over the world went in, Australia, Canada, UK, Israel. I can't remember all of the places, but everywhere that they went, the judges basically said the same things and did the same things. So it really doesn't matter where you're at in the world, their arguments are all pretty much the same.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you earlier, because we kind of, in the beginning, at least, we're talking specific to like the U.S. tax code. And I think in the U.S. there are certain legal protections that you have, especially when in the beginning, right, if you are arrested or something like that, about not talking to police officers, because in theory, anyway, there are legal protections from them doing violence to you. But yeah, so you're saying these things should be pretty much the same no matter where you're at.
Yeah. If you're in North Korea, they'll say, we have a Bill of Rights, we have a constitution, and because of your physical location, these rules apply to you. So that's what they'll try to say, is that because you're in the state of Texas, Texas codes and statutes apply, and that's what gives me the authority to, you know, even have this hearing.
Right.
And so what you want to do is, anytime you're going to attack an argument or a claim, you always want to repeat it back to them and get them to confirm it. This is called like steel manning. And so you would, your claim is that because I'm physically in Texas, the Texas codes and statutes apply to me, and you'll often get a yes. At which point we have a tactic that we call isolate. So we would isolate. Is there any other evidence that you rely on? And at that point you get them to say no. Now they're kind of boxed in a corner. So then you can ask. You really don't want to ever ask an open-ended question. Your question should be leading and have a yes-no answer. And the reason for this is because well, there's a couple reasons, but the judge will like filibuster, he'll be non-responsive. And then also, in order to make this work, we're not relying on the judge being ethical and saying, oh, you're right, there is no evidence, case dismissed. We're relying on the public pressure. The judge has to make it look good. And there's this illusion of authority. And what we're doing is we're beating down this illusion.
So we're talking about a jury trial here.
Not even. You're at arraignment, and typically arraignments, there's just a room full of people, and they're arraigning all day long. They're just taking pleas, guilty, not guilty. It takes 2 minutes, and you move to the next guy. So that you're in a room full
but you're dragging this out.
Yeah, yeah. We're actually doing something different than everybody else, and it's going to piss the judge off. It's going to piss the prosecutor off. But the people behind us, we need to be able to articulate we need them paying attention to us, because if we're in an empty courtroom, and it's just the judge and the prosecutor there, we then have to take whatever happens. We then have to get the record. So I suggest people record themselves, which is against their rules, but I'd get a recorder and have it in my pocket. So I don't have to rely, you know, I can go home and re-listen to it and learn what I should have done better or maybe where I made a mistake. But then you can share that with the public on the internet and drum up support. And they don't like that at all. We've had people go back into court and the prosecutor seen the videos, and then they will like ask the defendant, you know, were you recording? They'll accuse the defendant of recording. So it's just real interesting. But basically, yeah, we're not doing this to try to convince the people attacking us. We're doing this to gain support from everybody else.
Okay. All right. So let's keep going. Sorry, I know I kind of pushed you off on a tangent there about the jersey.
Yeah, we're going to go on all kinds of tangents talking about this. So, you know, we can talk about this for days and not really get it all.
Yeah. So you were saying that we've established, you know, by their own admission that in this case, particularly, like their justification for saying that I have to be bound by these rules is that I am within the bounds of the state of Texas, and that that's the only evidence they have on this.
Right. But like, so I can just finish these questions here. So like, you ask if the burden's on the prosecution here today, they'll say yes. Then you ask, am I presumed innocent of the allegations against me? They'll say yes. And then you ask, is jurisdiction one of those elements? And they'll say yes. So then you just confirm, you know, I'm just confirming here. So I'm presumed innocent of the element of jurisdiction. And you'll almost never be able to get that question out without being interrupted or thrown out of the room. But if you do, then the next question is, you know, the giant uppercut. This is everything right here. Has the prosecution described or provided any evidence as of now that would justify this court presuming jurisdiction to impose on me? And, you know, if you do get that out, they're going to lie. Like almost everything that comes out is going to be a lie. But they'll tell you yes. And they'll like, we have all their tactics listed down. You know, it'll be the physical location. They'll straw man you and say, oh, you don't think the laws apply to you? What are you, one of them sovereign citizens? And, you know, which is real bad because they consider those people terrorists.
Right.
Yeah. And so the difference between a sovereign citizen, a free man on the land, someone that's going in there similar to how we are, is they rely on narrative. They try to say, well, you know, I was driving as an individual, not as commercial. So these laws are commercial. They don't apply to me. They try to wiggle around the rules, and it's your narrative versus theirs, and you're never going to win. This doesn't rely on a narrative. It's just hardcore logic and ethics. And so, gotcha. What's going to happen? I'll cut to the chase. What's going to happen is the judge is going to enter a plea of not guilty on your behalf, and then schedule a trial. Depending on what you're in there for. I mean, like a lot of people go in for traffic court or drug charges. So obviously in a Bitcoin world here in the future, who knows, it could be a money transmitter crime situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then you go through arraignment, you get railroaded. And after that, you then continue to be a pest in their side, and you file a motion to vacate the plea, because the judge was biased, and we point
because he filed the not guilty.
Yeah, because okay, so I forgot to mention, we go in there with the intent to plead guilty. You actually type up a guilty plea that's unsigned, and so if the judge tries to enter a not guilty plea on your behalf, you submit this unsigned plea of guilty. You put it on the table. And that's now entered as evidence. So he can't say that you refuse to plea, or he can't claim that he was unable to ascertain a plea. And so when you file a motion, you know, you're going to file a motion, and you're going to then have a motion hearing where you then go and put this on the table again. And you may have the same judge, you may have a new judge, but, you know, essentially, until you make a name for yourself. They may make you go. We had a guy last year go through 16 arraignments.
Wow.
And then
so what's the justification there? Like, I mean, I guess what's the process there? Do they just say like, you're going to have to come back another day, or how does that work?
Yeah, they'll do different things. Like in this one case, they question his competency. So it wasn't 16 arraignments, but it was 16 hearings. And so if you say something, okay, so words are very important in here, and a couple wrong words will get you possibly thrown in jail on contempt. Or it can get you a court order to go see a doctor to see if you're competent to represent your quote unquote represent yourself. And it's actually represent. So when you get a lawyer, they're just representing your story. And when you have an attorney or a lawyer, they basically represent, you know, they have authority to speak for you. So some people still want to get like an attorney or a lawyer to help them with the paperwork and go through all this, but it's pretty dangerous because he or she's licensed by the same people the prosecution's licensed by and the same person the judge is. Now the judge and the prosecutor are both paid by the same people, the fictional state of Texas. And if you have a public defender, they're also paid by the state of Texas. So these are one of the things that we point out when we're in this adversarial game that we're playing.
So you don't, I mean, if you are going to go with an attorney, you don't want a public defender because their incentive structure is basically the same as...
They're all the same. No.
Yeah.
Okay. So they take an oath essentially not to challenge jurisdiction in the manner I'm describing.
Really?
No attorney is going to risk their career going in front of a judge and throwing shit at them like essentially what we're doing.
And they very much don't like it when you challenge their authority or when you kind of put things out. Like, so for example, the last time that I got called in for potential jury duty, it's a stupid law about in Texas where you can and cannot take firearms. And my understanding is that the case was involving someone who had his concealed permit, which I guess is a license to carry now. You can do concealed or open. And they had it in a place that you are not, even with a license, supposed to have it. And I asked the question just in jury selection. I just clarified and I said, do these charges come with a minimum sentencing? Because a minimum sentencing, it doesn't, you know, you should have in most cases, you have a separate hearing like of guilty, not guilty, and then a separate hearing to determine what's the punishment. But in minimum sentencing, that second one doesn't really happen, or there's at least a minimum that the hands are tied. And so I asked that, and they sat there for a minute, and the judge called the attorneys over and then basically said like that question had to be struck from the record.
Wow.
I was flabbergasted. I was just like, you can't even tell people whether this has a minimum sentence or not.
Yeah. Jury selection's interesting. So I take it you weren't selected then for the jury.
So I've changed my position on this point, because I was not really aware of the tactic of basically
jury nullification.
Going in. Yeah. Jury nullification. Yeah. That's the term I was looking for. Thank you. I wasn't really aware of that at that time. And so when they called me up and asked me, I basically told them that I could not be unbiased because I thought the law was an unconstitutional law, and they just kind of rolled their eyes at me and said, okay. And they moved me along.
Yeah. Yeah. I was selected, or I was in the pool, and, I was so excited that I was going to go in there and be able to do some jury nullification. And I actually got, it was a rape case from a man and a woman, and I actually was the alternate juror selected, which was pretty interesting. And the guy was guilty. There was like three or four women on the jury. I wasn't in there for deliberations, but I talked to one of the guys after, and he said the women, he was guilty. He basically admitted in trial that he raped this woman. And he was found not guilty because the women in the jury felt that the woman put herself in a bad situation.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's terrible. But so on the jury nullification or on in the jury, your point was that they don't even like you asking them any questions.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah, and it's true. Your defense attorney is basically trying to convince you to plead guilty. Like almost all of them is like, "Hey, we're going to cut a deal." You know, here's what I feel about defense attorneys, and this credit to Gary Capps, one of the guys in our chat. He said a lot of people when they get hemmed up, they ask their attorney, what's the best strategy for me? And then they almost always go with it. And it's very similar to going to a used car lot, explaining your situation and then telling the sales guy, go ahead and pick out the car that's right for me. And then that's essentially the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, whatever's gonna. Yeah. So in the defense attorney's standpoint, then in that case, you know, like, I guess their incentive is what can we do the fastest that I can maximize my profit?
Yeah. Well, they're willing to do most stuff that you request of them, as long as it's not going to piss the judge off or the prosecutor off or make it look really bad for their career. They're more focused on that aspect than actually getting you justice or, you know, not being attacked.
Right.
So I guess the point here is just, if you do get a, you know, a public pretender or a defense attorney, they're not likely to ask for evidence that the rules apply to you. And they're most likely going to try to convince you to pleading guilty or at least cooperating, which means giving them information. So, and again, this is like a real niche thing. I think that the strategy, if you have the more attack vectors you have, if you own a house, you got a wife and kids, you got a good job, you're not going to have time to go in and challenge this. And you're not going to want to risk all of those things. If you're a hardcore Bitcoiner who's now the majority of their wealth is in Bitcoin, they decided they didn't want to own stuff because it's an attack vector. Then there's not really anything somebody can do to you other than throw you in a cage. You're like in this great position to be able to verbally defend yourself in almost any situation.
Yeah. So, and that's a good point that, like, if you have all these other avenues that, those can be attack vectors in that sense. And so, this is probably not going to be enough for you. They'll go after your job and
they might garnish your wages. If you have
garnish your wages.
Yeah, if you have a KYC job, they can garnish your wages. A judge can go in and like mess with your bank accounts. They can have the bankers go do that. So there's all these things that they can just do to you without your participation. There's a saying, you might beat the charge, but you're not going to beat the ride, which is what we talked about with the guy that had 16 hearings before they basically offered him a deal of no fine, no jail time, no court fees, just plead guilty. And so like a lot of the time, that's what they do. People end up pleading guilty with this strategy after so long with no penalties or anything like that.
Gotcha.
Me personally, I probably wouldn't do that. But they don't want to, you know, lost my train of thought.
they're trying to drag it out because they have more or less an infinite pocketbook.
That's exactly where I was going. So, and Ansel talks about this a lot, that just tax collection gets super expensive with Bitcoin. And so without Bitcoin in the picture, they can spend all the money they want because they're likely to get something back out of it through, like, if you have something to lose. But with Bitcoin, they're spending all this money on all of these hearings. They're paying a judge, a prosecutor, two or three bailiffs or guards, probably, you know, after your first time in there, they're going to like bring guards in to stand next to you. This is one of their intimidation tactics. And so that all costs money. And eventually, if enough people are going through court in this manner, it's not going to be economically, they're not going to be incentivized to do it. And it kind of goes back to, like, when we talk about privacy and stuff, people tend to go after weak targets. If you make yourself a harder target, you're not going to be attacked. And so I think the game, theoretically, the courts would just start to be able to look at a profile of a quote unquote case and just be like, you know, this is a guy that's challenged before and there's nothing we can get from him. He's just going to cost us money. Let's move to an easier target.
Right. Because again, like you said, that if you're not dealing in the fiat, then they can't just go seize that money. Like, the collection of Bitcoin is very difficult and relies on violence at that point.
Right. And this reminds me of a thing we talk about. So in court, it's like the state's special record, right? They got the stenographer type person typing in there. There's records requests. Anybody can usually get transcripts. And so they don't like certain stuff being put on the record. So when they say, okay, you're charged with XYZ, and this is up to $1,000 fine and 30 days in jail. So you have the right to be informed. So you can say, oh, really? What do you mean by $1,000 fine? You know, and they'll look at you like crazy. They'll try to probably get you to take a competency type exam again. But to be able to get them to articulate $1,000 and a fine. Fine means that you have to give us these. And, you know, these dollars, there's a rule that they have that a punishment can't involve contracting with a third party. Now, so you can ask, where do I get these dollars? I don't have dollars. You're telling me I have to get to bring $1,000 to you. Where do I go get these? I mean, you have to ask, you do it Socratically, but the judge isn't really going to want to put on the record that dollars come from, you know, like, he's not going to be able to answer that. And as Bitcoiners, we know exactly where they come from and the whole dynamic involved in that. So that's actually one of the things I'm kind of excited about. If I ever get in there and jammed up, you know, and they start talking fines with dollars, they're going to fucking hate me.
Yeah. Do you have any examples of this that you know of where specifically, like, what do you mean by dollars has been used?
Yeah. We had one guy's name's Robbie. I can probably get the recording. So when people go in, they record their hearings and then they come back to, we have a Discord. It used to be Skype. And then they'll play the recording, and after every sentence, it's paused, and then we dissect. Well, okay, you could have made me ask, instead of asking that question, maybe you should have used this word instead of that one, and then you get the judge's response, and we just dissect everything. And one of them was, he did bring up the dollars and all that, and I think that they just kind of blew it off and rescheduled another hearing. They use that a lot. Like, okay, you're just in here asking a bunch of questions and because the judge, the way this works is a lot of the time, like I said, the judges you'll have different judges. And so if one of them doesn't want to deal with it, you know, he doesn't want to, you're making him look bad. And
right.
Judges hate getting looked bad. And they never want other judges higher than them looking at their case, criticizing the way they handled it. So a lot of right. them will do a recess. They'll say, look, you've got a lot of questions. It sounds like you don't know what's going on. And it sounds like you need an attorney to explain all these to you. We've got 100 people behind you waiting to get arraigned. Please step aside and we'll get you an attorney and scheduled, you know, back in another week. At which time you have to object, you know, objection. How can I determine what lawyer I need until I've been informed of the cause and nature of the proceedings? You know, and that just brings it back to, look, I'm here trying to plead guilty. We have a segue. So they're called the 1-2-3s. So when you get jammed up by either the prosecutor or the judge in there and they shut down your line of questioning, you can shift. Look, I'm only here because of the threats of violence. And so I want to resolve this today. I don't want to come back in a week. You know, I'm here to plead guilty.
What threat of violence?
Yeah. Well, so one of the tactics you can do is call the court clerk and say, look, I've got a piece of paper here that says I have a hearing tomorrow. And I'm just curious what happens if I don't show up. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, they'll think, oh, do you need to reschedule this? And you're like, no, I'm just curious what happens if I don't show up. And they'll say, well, an arrest.
You're saying this is before the arraignment?
Yeah. Say you have your arraignment tomorrow. And you can call the court clerk and you're recording the conversation and you ask what happens if you don't show up. She's going to say, well, there's going to be an arrest warrant issued. And then you need to clarify, well, what exactly do you mean by arrest warrant? I'm an idiot. Can you tell me what that means? And get them to actually articulate on the record that men with guns and a badge, if they see you, they will kidnap you and put you in a cage. Is essentially what an arrest warrant is. They're not going to say that. They're going to say a cop will find you. He'll apprehend you or arrest you and then take you to jail, basically. But you want her to clarify in as much language that we use in reality versus like legalese.
Right.
And then when you show up to the judge and the judge tries to reschedule your hearing, you know, you just point out, look, I only came here because of the violence. I want to mitigate this. And you're saying I broke rules. I just want to plead guilty. But before I do that, I need to make sure these rules apply to me.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the other thing I was thinking about is that I don't know about everywhere, but I know in a lot of places judges are elected. And so... when you're doing this, you know, what we talked about earlier of kind of, challenging their authority, potentially, you know, they don't want to look bad in front of a bunch of people. They don't want all the secrets out, right? Is that these are the people behind you in line and around and listening to this are the same people that, are potentially voting in the next, judge, whatever that's called, election.
Exactly. And when you put when that judge finds out that there's a YouTube video of that transcript with his full name on it and and you slapping, you know, making him look, you know, making him look dishonest or slimy or the tyrant that they are or the psychopath they are. I mean, these people are a psychopath. If you call them by their first name in court, they're liable to throw you in jail. Like, that's what we're dealing with here. I mean, it's very dangerous. And so this isn't for...
What's the justification on that? I mean, I know it's not like legitimate, but like, what's their claimed justification on that?
That you're disrespecting them, basically.
Oh my gosh.
They might allow you to call. They might say, that's not, you know, if you call them Josh instead of Your Honor, they might say, you will not address me by my name. You'll say judge or however they prefer. And if you do it again, I'm going to hold you in contempt, which means use violence on you.
Right.
Okay. And so here's another thing, another tactic a judge has is, so you're up there asking if you have the right to be informed, and he motions over to two guards in the back of the room, and they come stand within a foot, you know, on both sides of you, basically invading your personal space. Now, none of that's on the record, right? He just motioned over and you're asking a question. So you need to get it on the record. So, judge, do you feel threatened by the questions that I'm asking, that you motioned over two guards to stand near me? Or why did you motion two guards to stand near me? Are you feeling threatened? And now that's on the record, and that looks,
makes him look silly.
Yeah, it just shows that the judge motioned, you actually got it picked up on both the audio and the transcript.
The transcript.
Yeah. And so, it's, and so when you're in there too, you've got to be relaxed, calm. You cannot be in a state of fear. You almost have to laugh when he motions for the guards over. And you should. Seriously, I'm asking if I have the right to be informed, and you're calling guards over. And that shows you're calm, and to be able to laugh at that shows you're not intimidated, and it's not going to work next time. You know, it didn't work this time, and it's not going to work. So stop with it. And your beef really isn't even with the judge. This is something that is the prosecution's burden, and the judge is covering for the prosecution. And so you can point this out that, look, you guys get paid by the same people. I'm asking for evidence from the prosecution. You're covering for them. And so when you get records of all this and then you put these on motions, at some point you're just not worth their time, and they're going to likely dismiss the case.
Gotcha.
They're going to, and like one of the criticism is, oh, well, your guys' strategy isn't legit. The only reason you get it dismissed is because you file all this paperwork and act annoying. Well, I don't care why it works. I mean, there is no evidence of authority. So, and like, I just like to point out, let me find my notes here on authority.
Right.
To me, authority is the belief that another man has a higher claim to your life, liberty, and property than you do. So if you believe that, then this is not for you.
Right. But I don't believe that anyone else has a, you know, bigger claim to that than that. I mean, it just feels like if you, I mean, you can't openly challenge their authority.
Well, no, that's exactly what we're doing. We could go in there and they say, how do you plead, guilty or not guilty? And you could just say, I intend to plead guilty, but first, has the prosecution provided any evidence as of now regarding jurisdiction? I just want to know, it's a yes or no. Have they handed it from them to you? You could just go right in for that. But then you're not setting all these little traps.
Right.
And I just feel like, So everybody goes in with a little bit different strategy, but for the most part, because it is, it's, you know, it depends on the judge, the charges, what's at stake. But really, you could just go in and you know, call that out. I mean, a matter of fact, you're actually, so there's some motions you can submit before you go in.
Okay.
And we can talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. Let's do that.
So a motion for discovery is basically asking the prosecution for all of the evidence that they're plan on using to prosecute you. Then there's a Brady request, which is similar. It's all of the information that the prosecution has gathered. So they have a bucket. They're only going to use certain pieces to prosecute you. And the reason why this is a rule is there was a guy, last name Brady, that was wrongfully convicted. And they later found out that the prosecution had information that would have, that had the defense known about, they could have used to prove his innocence.
Yeah.
And so you're getting all of the information, you're getting all of the evidence they have, then you're getting the evidence that they rely on. And then there's a third motion, motion in limine. And so this is like some legalese jargon, and I don't typically use it, but that's what the motion's called. And it's basically to limit the evidence to what they have. Basically, you're requesting that they don't introduce new evidence. And gotcha. So if you can file those before you even go into the arraignment, and then when they ask you to plea, you basically, it's now a motions hearing, and you say, I have some motions on the table. These need to be addressed. And then you can have the fourth motion to dismiss, which says that on this motion, it basically has some of their rules that have to be true, and then some case law that to back it up. And what you're saying is that, you know, the discovery, the Brady request, none of the evidence that's required is in there. So since it's not in there, I'm motioning to dismiss for failure to state a case, is what it's called. And the judge will normally just deny your motions. he'll grant probably he'll deny the dismissal.
Yeah.
But that's fine. You can submit it again when there's more information that comes about. And when he denies it, you ask, are you denying it based on your opinion or because of facts and evidence?
Yeah.
And if he says because of facts and evidence, you can say, well, are you withholding evidence from me? Because I was given a pile of information and it's not in there, but you're claiming that that there is. So now you're withholding evidence from me. So it's just bind after bind after bind
that you're using the tactics that they would try and use against you. I mean, because they are going to try and use these same tactics against you.
Yeah. I mean, basically, like if you were to make a claim, right, then it's your claim versus their claim, and they're just always going to rule in their favor.
Yeah.
It is so hard, Josh, to not make a claim. You have to actively listen, which is like a skill that you have to practice. And then you have to be able to, everything you say basically has to come out in a question. And there's a question. So judges don't have to answer questions. But if they say something, you have the right to clarify. So we're not actually asking questions when we're in a courtroom. We're actually just clarifying things that other people have already said. So the prosecution makes the claim. So we're clarifying for evidence on that. And then when the judge asks us to plea, we're basically clarifying, well, before I plea, are you going to be fair and ethical?
Of course they're going to say yes.
Yeah.
So kind of bouncing back earlier, you're talking about recording all of this. But are there preferred methods to doing this? Because I don't foresee them, you know, willingly allowing you to come in with a recording device.
Yeah. I suggest getting, I mean, you can, a lot of people use their cell phone. Because you can just have like your cell phone sitting either in your bag or on the table. If it's in your pocket, it's really hard to pick up audio. You'll hear like whooshing noises from the pocket. You also want to have your phone in airplane mode because that prevents other signals and stuff from jamming it up. I guess people have had problems before with the recording when it's not in airplane mode. But really, if you just get like a $10 or $15 audio recorder off like Amazon, like there's pen recorders, ones in the glasses. You can even get like audio.
Yeah.
It's really best if you can have someone come to court with you and sit up front and do the recording for you on your behalf. That way you don't, some people feel nervous that, when they have the recording device on there, especially when, like in the one case, the person had then published it on YouTube with commentary, right? Like, how stupid is this judge for saying this? And just really laying into the judge and the prosecutor. And that was mentioned before they even got started. And, you know, it's just like another thing to contend with that you really don't want to. You really want to focus on the evidence, not make this about like a recording thing.
So you're saying that they, I'm just clarifying, yeah. They, that this person released this YouTube video with the commentary between the arraignment and the hearing.
Yeah. So the first arraignment happened, it was like 5-6 minutes. And then they went back to the Skype chat, played it for people. And then, there's a couple guys, one that goes by the name of Ethics. His name's, Joe. He was from Hawaii. He beat some drug charges. And he's like, he's very good at this, so he can just break mm-hmm. down audio, and he just really gives it to the judge, talking about basically laying it all out, and that it for a layman person to hear. And I don't know if they then sent the audio to the prosecutor and the judge, or if they just were watching their YouTube channels. But it is a strategy to publish it on YouTube and then send it to the prosecutor so they know that people are watching. You know, this is getting published out on the internet. And, you know, they don't deal with this very often. Like 990 some people out of 1,000 go through there, and maybe 10 of them effectively challenge. Yeah, there might be like 50 people that challenge, but not effectively. And so it's not very often they have to deal with somebody that's effective when they go in.
Gotcha. You know, if somebody wants to.
Oh, I will point out in St. Louis, they installed lockers. So when you go into a courthouse or a court, they have metal detectors and guards. They actually put lockers up that and required people to lock their phones up and electronical devices. So this one kid, he was in his early 20s going in, he had no way to record it. Now, you can ask, they're obviously recording it, but what they want to do is charge you $25 to $100 for a copy of it. So it's you like in one of the scripts, this is actually Joe's script. He says, so how do you plea? And he says, before I begin, is this hearing being recorded on audio and video by that camera right there above you? And they'll probably say yes. And then how soon can I get a copy of that recording? And then the next question is, if I do as you say, and they deny its existence or mysteriously lose or edit it, who will be responsible and what will be the consequences? So you can go in there and I mean, these are all relevant clarifications about the record and the proceedings. And so at that point, you know, you can say, look, I'm just going to put my own recorder here on this table because I have bad memory and I just need a record of everything. And what a lot of people do is after they get the recording, you go and you can have a third party, like somebody off Fiverr, transcribe it just like the court would do. And then when you submit your motions, you know, you put all of this on there. You know, the judge said I had a right to be informed, but then a minute and a half later would refuse to answer, you know, a relevant clarification. Here's what he said. You know, and then you have the recording and you have the actual transcript, and it's not you that transcribed it. You know, like they might have a contention with that. So it was somebody completely different that did it, that has no skin in the game here.
Yeah. Interesting. something that you and I were talking about on Twitter. You were talking about the you know, there are two ways to be fooled thing. It's a Kierkegaard quote. Yeah,
there's two ways to be. Let me pull up the actual quote. There are two ways to be fooled. One is to believe what is not true. The other is to refuse to believe what is true. And I had this just kind of tied in with words because they speak a different language. They speak legalese, which is a foreign language to most people, myself included. So if we're in an adversarial situation and you're using words I don't understand, I'm likely to be fooled. And so, and it's also like the Socratic method of investigation. Like words have different meaning based on the context. Words really don't have meaning. You know, there are means to find meaning. People assign words meaning, and they often misuse words. So like when somebody says something, you almost always want to repeat it back to them to make sure you understand it right. And if you don't, I mean, that's one of the ways like to be fooled. Like if somebody misspeaks and like in this case, like if you believe that the court has authority over you and that's not true, you're being fooled. And the consequence of that could be devastating. It could be years in jail. It could be a ton of money. So using the Socratic method of investigation ensures that you're less, well, it makes it so you're less likely to be fooled. And this works with your significant other, your parents, your kids, your boss, everybody.
What do you mean when you say that?
Using Socratics. I mean, if your boss asks you to do something and you don't understand it, I mean, clarify. Some of the time you might find that you're being asked to do something for like, and it's like an there's all these, I used to work in a financial corporation and like there would be a procedure that had been going on for 10 years and it's like, why are we doing this? And, you know, I keep
right.
And you inquire about it, well, you know, using Socratic method of investigation of who, or, you know, why are we doing this? When did we start? Who implemented it, that sort of thing. It might be like this was implemented for something that's not, it's not even a report anymore. Like this, we needed you to do this task so we could create this report. Well, if nobody reads that report anymore, we're just like wasting time here, or nobody,
yeah.
Metrics is like no longer valid. And like, yeah, and then just people make claims all the time. You know, they'll claim. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of fun to investigate their claims that people make. And you'll often find that they're contradicting themselves or they misspoke. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I found that is maybe not even necessarily like an intentional, like they're intentionally trying to deceive you. They just misspoke and then they contradicted themselves and now they don't want to look foolish. So they double down on something.
Yeah. Or it was true to them. It's just, they use the wrong word.
Oh yeah, that's true too.
Yeah. Like freedom. Like you can ask people, well, what does freedom mean to you? You know, and it's like, we have all of these different ideas of freedom. So if someone claims I have freedom, or I don't have freedom, mm-hmm. and you start to inquire about that, you'll find that a lot of people don't know what they're talking about, or they don't have, they're not able to put it. Maybe they do know, but they're not able to put it into words, which goes back to, you know, like words being tricky. Like without words, we wouldn't be able to manipulate others as easily if words did not exist. I mean, it's the truth.
Yeah. No, I would not disagree with that. I would have the caveat, though, that it would also not be as easy to cooperate with people.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not advocating to get rid of words. I'm just saying that
I know you're not.
That when you look at the way people are deceived and manipulated, it's
for sure.
Words is like the main way. Oh, let's talk about this Francis Bacon quote.
Yeah.
Who questions much shall learn much and retain much. So what he's describing here is Socratic. So who questions much? So people that don't make claims and ask questions shall learn much. And so you're constantly learning about what other people think and about the nature of reality around us. And the retain mm-hmm. much. Now, this is where it gets tricky, is what do you think he means by retain?
Well, this is where we get into like what do words mean, right? Words can have multiple meanings mm-hmm. depending on the context. So you could, I could see one way of thinking about it is that like to have a larger body of knowledge, to retain it, to understand and remember much. But you could also, in the context that we've been discussing, you know, you keep information to yourself.
Awesome,
you retain
dude.
It. You're not,
that's awesome.
You're not, you broadcasting.
It. Yeah. Almost everybody. Yeah. Yeah. Well, to say they'll have a hard time describing it, but it's basically retaining what you learn for future use. And that's like the exoteric meaning, the meaning that just giving it a first glance that people think, but what he right. meant by it was that when you start questioning people, you learn so much about them and so much about just how they think and operate that you then, and that you can use that to manipulate and control them, that you then want to start retaining what information you actually give out.
Yeah.
And it like when you think of it like that, it's like, ooh. I mean, like there's all these philosophy quotes and all these quotes of these, you know, Socrates and Plato, and like this Francis Bacon was kind of I think people say he's kind of on the dark side where he's like trying to manipulate people for his own mm-hmm. gain. And that's, you know, and in this quote, you know, he wrote it in a way that, if you didn't know that, like if you didn't know what he really meant, you wouldn't think he's a bad guy. I mean, I still don't think people that retain information are bad, but his
right.
motivation for retaining it was so he was not manipulated
right.
by others.
Well, and to be fair, like if I had just stumbled across, you know, this little quotes thing that you sent me with that, if you hadn't sent me that, if I just stumbled across it somewhere else, I probably wouldn't have given it the second thought of like, what else could it mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I would have just taken the surface level meaning of like, you know, gathering information.
Yeah, the guy that put that quote out in one of our chats, there was like six or seven of us, and no one came up with what the right retain. And then when the yeah. guy explained, and he, you know, he monologued for, you know, a good 10 minutes explaining all these dynamics, and it was just like my mind was blown, and I was like, man, it's starting to fit together a little bit.
Yeah. So, if somebody wanted to, is there a way for other people to jump in on the group that you were talking about?
Yeah. So the, I guess the meat and potatoes of it is I'm on, Discord in Ansel's, Bitcoin and Markets server. And then there's mm-hmm. like two or three other active servers specifically for the court stuff. But I've got a channel in the Bitcoin and Markets one where I put all of the good stuff about this strategy. And then if anybody's interested, which some people are, then I'll invite them to the other chats with where actual strategy sessions are happening. You know, people have an allegation, a ticket, a case, and a trial coming up next week, and they want to role play. Role playing is the biggest thing. Like you have to role play. And this is what prosecutors and attorneys do all the time. They role play with people when mm-hmm. you got to speak. And so,
yeah, I was. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think that would have to be something you do because this is just not, because it is so foreign to the normal way that we conduct our lives. or at least for most people, that this is not something you're going to be able to, you know, listen to this episode one time and remember all these things. Even if you go through like the different videos, and I'll link to some of this stuff in the show notes. Like, even if you look over all this stuff, you do it one time, like there's no way you're going to remember all this stuff and not get flustered under the pressure, you know, or perceived pressure in the courtroom.
Right. Yeah. And I will. And it takes time, and, but it's the people that are naturally, that there's just certain profiles of people that this would fit. And if it comes kind of naturally to you, it's not like, you know, a lot of people feel like it's like work going into a chat and mm-hmm. playing for a couple hours. But other people like me, I just love listening in and then help strategizing. Like, what are you going to say if the judge says this? You know, and then we spend a half hour figuring out how exactly to answer it with the words, and you write it down, you internalize it, and then you go in and see what the judge throws at you, see how you do.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, yeah. Cool. So, to wrap it up, just I guess that Discord or on Twitter, I'm at defundthestate_. And just, I think I have my DMs open. You can message me, and then I'll invite you to the different chats.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Jeff, this has been a lot of fun, and I hope I don't ever have to use this, but I'm glad to have this under my tool belt, and I'm glad we got to have this discussion and put this information out there so people can start looking at it. And just, like I said, hopefully we don't have to use it, but to be prepared, you know, this is one of the things that in that video where that, like I said, I'll put in the show notes, where he's talking about not talking to the police. One of the things he talks about is, you know, there are so many different laws that there's no way that you can know what you like if you've never violated one, right? Like, it's just impossible. And so it's just a matter of time. And then there's a police officer at the end of that video that kind of talks about some things and backs up what the law professor is saying. And he's like, I guarantee you that if I get in my cruiser and I follow someone long enough, I can find a law that they're going to break on the road.
Right.
It's
the nature of our reality with the man-made laws.
Yeah. So it's good to have these things in your bat belt. What is it? Utility belt. So anyways, all right, Jeff, anything else?
No, just thanks for having me on and helping me meme this concept out. I hope some Bitcoiners take interest and want to participate.
Yeah, very cool. All right, man. Well, this has been fun. Thanks. All right, that's going to do it for the episode today. Hope you guys really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that. I know this is audio, so you can't see it, but I had a big fat grin every time he'd throw out something where I could see the line of like the, you know, the judge or the prosecutor saying something that countered something they said earlier, or when I could see where the trap he was going for was laid. So this is a lot of fun. I'm the kind of person that enjoys solving puzzles or whatever, you know, when you tell me that there's a rule. It's not that I really want to break the rule to be devious. I like figuring out, does this rule actually work? Does this puzzle, is it actually unsolvable, or can I get around it? Like I said, not maliciously. It's just like, that's how my brain works. Like, I just want to solve these puzzles. And so anyway, if you're interested, I got lots of good links in the show notes. Like I said, that first one, maybe the biggest, easiest one for everybody, is just like, don't talk to the police. Even if you did nothing wrong, and the video goes into that, like, even if you did nothing wrong, you're totally innocent, it does not benefit you to talk to the police. It, like, that doesn't actually work in your favor to clear your name. So, and the video goes into like the whys of that. And, so everyone should check that out if nothing else. And then, like I said, I'll include links to, the Discord server and to Jeff's Twitter, and you can check those things out. So, and I'm sure there'll be people on here who disagree, and that's fine too. Like, go tell him that you think he's wrong. Cause I'd love to watch that interaction too. All right, you guys know the drill. You can follow me on Twitter @bottomshelfbtc. If you want to support the show, the best thing you can do to support the show is to share it with everybody you know, and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And then if you want to support beyond that, if you want to support financially, you can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate, and there are ways there that you can send me some Bitcoin. And you can also go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook. Those are the Tuttle Twins books. This is just my reference link. So doesn't change the price of the books at all. It's just some great books on liberty and free market and those kind of ideas, you know, presented in a really simple way. You know, doesn't water down the core message, but it presents it in a way that kids can understand, or I mean, even adults. I know I've said that a lot, but I love those books. So check those out. All right, for Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.